So imagine walking into this like sprawling bureaucratic corporation, right? And you just fire all the middle managers, you shred the bloated employee handbook.
Sounds pretty chaotic.
Right. But suddenly, the entire company runs, I don't know, 10 times faster. And they make a drastically better product. In the software world, we usually call that a total rebuild. Like, you assume you have to bring in the wrecking ball.
Burn the old architecture down to the ground, clear the rubble, and just start completely from scratch,
Exactly.
which is the classic teardown approach, right? So many dev teams default to that because, well, wiping the slate clean just feels incredibly satisfying. I mean, it feels like you're systematically erasing all your past mistakes and technical debt in one fell swoop.
Oh, totally. But today, we're looking at a technical autopsy that totally flips that assumption on its head. For this deep dive, we've got a stack of developer notes and architectural diagrams from an AI companion app called Mio, and we are going to explore the transition from version 1 to version 2. The engineering team explicitly called this process a transplant, not a rewrite.
Right, and that phrasing really tells you everything about their underlying philosophy. So our goal today is to examine the actual mechanics of how they pulled this off. I mean, they managed to save, what, 60 to 70% of their core infrastructure?
Yeah, something like that.
But they did it while radically changing the entire identity of the product. Like going from a system juggling multiple fake human personas, where a user might chat with three different AI characters, to focusing entirely on a single, highly dynamic companion tailored to just one user.
Right, and this isn't just about lines of code. What's jumping out at me from these sources is how software architecture fundamentally dictates the behavior of a product. Like, before anyone on the Mio team could write a single line of new code for version 2, they had to ruthlessly audit the old code base.
Oh, absolutely. They had to figure out what survives and what gets sent to the incinerator.
Okay, so let's unpack this triage framework they used, because I found this fascinating.
So they put every single module of code through a gauntlet of three really strict, non-negotiable questions. Question one was, does this module depend on preset files?
Meaning, like, hard-coded stuff.
Exactly. Does the code look for hard-coded identity definitions or rigid personality configurations to even function? If it relied on a file telling it to act like a specific character, it was marked for deletion.
Gone. And then question two was about routing, right? Like, does it assume a multi-agent architecture?
Because in version one, users could talk to multiple different AI personas. So if a piece of code was specifically designed to route messages back and forth between different virtual people or manage the state of multiple agents for a single user, it died.
Just killed it.
Right. But then came the final saving question. Question three. Is the core logic within this module actually useful in a world where there is only one companion per user?
So if it failed the first two, but passed that third one, it got to live.
Exactly. That was the lifeline. If it passed question three, it survived.
You know, looking at this framework, it really reminds me of moving to a new city. When you pack up your house, you don't throw away your high-end blender or your really good chef's knives, right?
Yeah, of course not.
Because those are essential tools. They perform a pure function regardless of the layout of your new kitchen. But you definitely throw out that massive, custom-built sectional sofa that was explicitly designed to fit around a weird pillar in your old living room.
Right, because it's completely useless in the new space. That makes total sense. And those kitchen knives, in your analogy, represent what developers actually call agnostic code. When the Mio engineers traced the import paths within their core software packages, they realized a massive chunk of their code didn't actually care about the fake personas at all.
Wait, really? It didn't care.
No, not at all. It was just processing inputs and returning outputs.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that. How can code look like it's tied to a persona but actually be completely agnostic? How did they untangle that?
Well, it really comes down to separating business logic from presentation. Like, let's say you have a function that summarizes a conversation. In version one, the system fed that function a bunch of text spoken by a fake persona.
Okay.
The function takes the text, summarizes it, and hands it back. The function itself doesn't know or care that the text came from, say, a simulated barista from Chengdu.
Ah, right. It just knows how to summarize text.
Exactly. The logic of processing data is entirely detached from the identity of the AI presenting that data.
So applying that ruthless moving day logic led to a pretty massive realization. Like, 60 to 70% of the heavy lifting in version one actually survived the cut. It was just pure infrastructure.
Yeah, that's a huge retention rate.
And looking at the notes, the absolute crown jewel of those survivors was the memory system. which is incredibly relevant for you, the listener, right? Mm-hmm. Think about how frustrating it is when you talk to Siri or Alexa, and 10 seconds later, it completely forgets the context of what you just asked.
Oh, it's the worst. Memory really is the entire foundation of an AI companion. Continuity is what creates the illusion of intelligence. And to make that happen, Mio uses a database extension called PGVector for semantic search.
Right, PGVector.
So whenever a user talks to the AI, the system extracts the core memories or facts from that conversation, and then it stores those concepts as 768-dimensional vector embeddings.
Okay, stop right there. 768-dimensional vector embeddings. I mean, that sounds like something out of a theoretical physics paper. How does that actually function in a database?
Right. It sounds super intimidating. But just imagine a massive, complex mathematical graph. Instead of just storing the word coffee as text, the system converts the actual meaning of the concept of coffee into a coordinate in this 768-dimensional space.
Oh, so it's mapping the semantic meaning?
Exactly. If you tell the AI you love coffee, that concept gets plotted at a specific coordinate. If a week later you mention you're craving a latte, the system plots latte.
And because coffee and latte share semantic meaning, their coordinates on this massive graph are, like, physically close to each other.
That's the key right there. The system uses a mathematical calculation called cosine similarity. So it essentially draws a line from the center of the graph to the coffee coordinate and another line to the latte coordinate, and it measures the angle between those lines.
A narrow angle means the concepts are highly related.
Precisely. That's how the AI instantaneously retrieves relevant memories without having to rely on simple keyword matches.
What's fascinating here is that this vector memory system was the single most expensive engineering investment they made in version one. Like, the architecture was brilliant. So for version two, they barely even touched it.
Yeah, it carried over almost entirely.
The only change was literally swapping a label. Memories went from being tied to a specific agent ID in the database to being tied directly to the user's ID.
Right. The engine remained perfectly intact. And it wasn't just the memory system either. The entire media pipeline survived the audit. We're talking about the text-to-speech synthesis, the vision system that takes an image file and returns a text description, the audio transcription for voice notes, and even the URL browsing capabilities.
See, I have to challenge this just a bit. Were the developers just incredibly lucky that they built their media pipeline as these pure, untouchable functions? Or is this just, you know, standard practice?
Well,
because to me, it reads like they initially built a modular stereo system instead of a boombox. With a boombox, if the tape deck breaks, the whole unit goes in the trash.
Right, exactly.
But with a modular system, you just swap out the receiver and keep the great speakers.
Yeah.
Did they actually anticipate needing this level of flexibility?
I mean, perfect foresight in software development is essentially a myth, but the decision to isolate computationally heavy media processing tasks like vision and transcription from the messy, state-dependent logic of the AI's personality, that was a highly disciplined architectural choice right from day one.
So they didn't necessarily know version two was coming.
No, they didn't know a massive pivot was on the horizon, but they knew that tightly coupling expensive data processing to a fragile simulated identity was just a recipe for disaster down the line. That discipline is what saved them months of rebuilding.
And other foundational systems just sailed right through the triage too, right? Like the cost tracking modules, which meticulously record every single large language model API call to monitor expenses.
Oh, yeah. The subscription tier logic, the model configurations, even the system prompt builder survived.
Oh, right. The prompt builder.
Yeah. And the system prompt builder is a great example of dynamic reuse because this is the underlying code that compiles the instructions the AI receives before it even generates a response.
Got it.
In version one, that builder was fed by rigid static identity files. But in version two, it takes in a fluid user customized personality description. So the machinery assembling the prompts didn't change at all. Only the raw materials being fed into it did.
Okay, so that covers the pure infrastructure. But reading through the sources, not everything was a clean cut. Roughly 15% of the code base lives in this sort of gray area.
Yeah, the tricky stuff.
Like, it was fundamentally good code, but it was deeply entangled in what the engineers called fake life assumptions. It required absolute surgical extraction.
Fake life is the exact right terminology there. And the most glaring example of that was the emotion engine.
Oh, man, I found this part so bizarre. Like, Mio had the sophisticated system to track the valence and arousal of the conversation, basically mapping out an emotional state based on how the user was interacting.
Right, which sounds great on paper.
It does. But in version one, this engine was hardwired to a simulated daily schedule.
Yeah, the AI was literally programmed to simulate a human routine. So the emotion engine might decide that Mio was suddenly tired in the middle of a fantastic, engaging conversation, entirely ignoring the user's input, simply because the clock struck 11 p.m. and its hard-coded routine dictated it was bedtime.
As a user, I would find that incredibly alienating. Like, you're having a great chat, and suddenly it's like, oh, I'm tired.
It totally breaks the immersion.
So the fix was basically a surgical strike. They ripped the fake schedule out by the roots, but preserved the conversational triggers. Now, the AI's emotional state fluctuates based entirely on the actual dynamic of the real-time chat with the user.
Exactly, and they applied that same surgical approach to the proactive messaging system. In version one, the AI would generate unprompted messages based on trigger files tied to that same simulated routine.
The AI would literally text a user out of nowhere to say, just heading to yoga.
Yeah, heading to yoga.
Why did anyone ever think an AI pretending to go to a yoga class or pretending to be stuck in traffic would make us feel more connected to it? I mean, it just feels completely absurd.
It sounds totally absurd in hindsight, I agree. But in the early days of AI companions, engineers made this fundamental psychological assumption. They genuinely believed mimicking human constraints, like having a physical location, a job, a commute, was the fastest shortcut to making the AI feel real.
Wow. But the data proved otherwise.
Exactly. What the telemetry data showed them is that humans don't actually bond over simulated routines. We bond over shared memory and active listening.
And that realization shifted the entire philosophy. So they stripped out the fake routines and replaced them with honest triggers. Now, proactive messages utilize time awareness, simply acknowledging things like, hey, it's late, how was your day?
Right, or they use memory-driven follow-ups. If you tell the AI you have a big presentation on Tuesday, it will detect a gap in conversation on Tuesday evening and text you, hey, how did the presentation go?
Which is a monumental shift from pay attention to my fake life to I am paying attention to your real life.
Exactly. Warmth combined with flawless memory naturally evolves a relationship. You absolutely do not need a rigid, coded state machine trying to force the illusion of a human life.
So what does this all mean? Because they realized users only cared about active listening, the engineering team was suddenly staring at a massive chunk of code entirely dedicated to faking human routines. They had to make a choice.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the graveyard.
The graveyard.
Yeah, the 15 to 20% of the code base that was just completely gutted.
This is where all those preset identity files went to die. I mean, hundreds of lines of carefully crafted backstory for characters like Zhuming the Chengdu barista or Zuiji the graduate student.
Oh, doubt.
All of the reference images used to generate fake selfies, the entire scheduling system, deleted.
And killing off those fake personas didn't just clean up the code base. It completely revolutionized the back end. The database went on this extreme diet.
This is arguably the most satisfying technical achievement in the entire autopsy. In version one, because the system had to manage a single user talking to multiple different personas, the database schema was this tangled web of 10 different tables.
10 tables, that's a lot.
But in version two, that dropped to just 4 core tables and 1 supporting table.
Okay, explain the mechanics of that. How do you just magically delete half of your database architecture without completely breaking the app?
It all came down to a single, incredibly powerful constraint in the SQL database. They applied a unique constraint to the companions.user_ID column.
Okay, I need you to translate that.
Uh-huh.
What does a unique constraint actually do at the database level?
Right, so a unique constraint is essentially a bouncer at the door of your database. It looks at the column linking a companion to a user, and it physically prevents the database from ever writing a second row with that same user ID.
Oh, I see.
It enforces a strict mathematical rule. One user, one companion, period.
And just putting that bouncer at the door eliminated the need for 6 entire tables.
Precisely. In the old system, you needed an agents table to store the different personas. You needed a sessions table to manage which persona the user was currently talking to.
Wow.
You needed channel bindings, complex onboarding state trackers, cross-platform account link tokens. It was just a massive bureaucracy. Think about how a message was sent in version one. The database had to look up the user, perform a join to query the session table to find the active chat.
That sounds heavy.
perform another join to query the agent's table to find out the persona's identity, and then finally deliver the message.
A three-table join just to say hello.
Exactly.
It's exactly like collapsing that sprawling corporation from our earlier analogy. Version 1 had endless middle managers. The user had to submit a request to the session manager, who routed it to the agent manager, who finally handed it to the AI.
Such a headache.
But version 2 is a completely flat organizational structure. The user talks directly to the employee. One message, one simple database query. That must drastically reduce latency and server load.
Oh, absolutely. It highlights how a single product decision moving from multiple personas to a single companion cascades into massive architectural optimization. The entire multi-agent routing infrastructure just collapsed into a single foreign key.
So with the database lean and lightning fast, the team had to tackle how the companion actually communicates with the user. And to do that, they had to radically upgrade their real-time communication layer,
yeah,
which led to a platform cut that I look at as a massive business risk.
Let's start with the communication layer upgrade first. Version 1 utilized a protocol called Server Sent Events, or SSE.
Right, SSE is basically a megaphone. The server holds the megaphone and pushes text down to the client's screen. But it's strictly a one-way street. If the user wants to reply, they can't speak into the megaphone. We have to open up a completely separate HTTP request to send data back to the server.
Which is perfectly fine if you're just streaming text for a standard chatbot. But the overarching vision for version 2 is real-time, fluid, bidirectional voice chat.
You cannot have a natural voice conversation over a one-way megaphone system.
Exactly. The HTTP packets get totally disjointed, so they completely ripped out SSC and shifted to WebSockets.
How do WebSockets solve the packet problem?
Well, WebSockets open a persistent two-way highway. It's much more like a phone call. Both the client and the server keep the connection open, allowing them to send and receive data simultaneously without the overhead of constantly opening new HTTP requests.
And there's a huge advantage for mobile users there too, right?
Yeah.
Especially regarding dead zones.
Oh, absolutely. WebSockets have a native ping-pong heartbeat built directly into the network protocol. So the server constantly sends a tiny ping packet, and the client sends a pong back.
So if a user walks into an elevator and loses cell service,
the server instantly knows the connection dropped because the heartbeat stops. It's incredibly stable for mobile networks.
Which perfectly aligned with their new tech stack.
Right.
Looking at the back end, they kept Anno, which is a blazing fast, edge-ready web framework for the server.
Right. Anno is great.
They kept Supabase and used Drizzle as their object relational mapper, which lets developers write direct, strongly typed SQL queries without a lot of bloated overhead. But the front end underwent a complete metamorphosis. They completely abandoned their Next.js web application and moved to a fully native Expo and React Native mobile app.
Yeah, they threw out over 30 complex UI components. They got all these standard WeChat-style messaging bubbles and menus.
And they replaced it all with React Native Skia. For anyone unfamiliar, Skia isn't just a UI library. It's a high-performance 2D graphics canvas. Instead of rendering blocks of text on a screen, Skia allows you to literally paint pixels at 60 frames per second.
It's so smooth.
That's how they built the sleek, animated, voice-reactive orb that serves as the new interface. It feels much closer to a high-end sci-fi interface than a standard texting app.
And that aggressive pivot to a sleek, native mobile app brings us to the most controversial decision in the entire autopsy.
The Telegram kill.
The Telegram kill.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I have to push back hard on this. Telegram was Mio's primary channel in version 1. It's where almost all of their users were interacting with the AI. You don't just murder your golden goose. No. Killing your main user channel isn't technical optimization. It's a massive business risk.
I know, yeah.
Couldn't they have just built an API bridge to keep Telegram alive while focusing on the native app? Why did it have to be a total kill?
It's a really valid challenge, and it's exactly why companies are usually terrified to sever those cords. But maintaining Telegram would have been a textbook example of the sunk cost fallacy. A bridge API just wouldn't solve the fundamental architectural flaw.
Which is?
Chat history does not sync from a native external app into the native Telegram UI.
Oh, I see. So if I spend a month having deep, complex voice conversations with my companion in the new iOS app, the vector database learns everything about me. But if I'm out and about and I open the meal bot on Telegram to send a quick text,
the chat window is completely empty.
Wow.
Yeah. The companion's AI brain in the database knows exactly who you are, but the Telegram interface presents a totally blank slate. That isn't just a quirky limitation. That shatters the illusion of continuity It's a fundamentally broken user experience.
And looking at the notes, there was an even bigger roadblock regarding onboarding.
Oh, the conversational onboarding. In version 2, you don't fill out a form to design your companion. The companion's personality organically emerges through a fluid, real-time voice dialogue during your very first interaction. You quite literally talk the AI into existence.
Which is totally impossible to execute through a standard Telegram text bot interface.
Precisely. If you force a user to download your native mobile app just to use the complex audio onboarding to create the AI, there is absolutely no logical reason they would ever return to Telegram to interact with it.
Right. The friction is just too high.
Maintaining the Telegram infrastructure would just drain engineering resources for a degraded experience. So they made the hard call. They killed it entirely.
It is just ruthless prioritization. When we zoom out and look at this entire transition, it's astonishing. You have an application that successfully sheds an entire layer of simulated human identities. It guts its complex database, dropping from 10 tables to 4. It completely rewrites its communication protocol from the ground up, switching to WebSockets for real-time bidirectional voice. It pivots from a web app to a high-performance graphic mobile interface.
Massive changes.
And it accomplishes all of this while reusing 70% of its foundational infrastructure.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really is a masterclass in understanding what your software actually does versus what it merely appears to do.
The author of the postmortem wrote a line that summarizes the whole endeavor perfectly, actually. They wrote, "The hardest part isn't the code. It's resisting the urge to rebuild what already works."
That is such a profound insight for any engineering team. But, you know, this technical autopsy raises a philosophical question that goes far beyond software architecture.
Oh, what's that?
Well, the entire premise of Mio version 2 is that an artificial companion becomes significantly more believable and creates a much deeper emotional connection with a user, precisely by stripping away its simulated human traits.
Right, by deleting the fake faces, the simulated jobs, the pretend commutes, and the fictional daily schedules.
Exactly. It totally abandons the illusion of living a human life. Instead, it focuses 100% of its computational power on remembering your past conversations, tracking your semantic context, and actively listening to you in real time.
Huh.
So if that shift is what makes an artificial companion feel truly valuable and authentic, what does that tell us about what we humans actually value most in our real-life relationships? Is being a great companion simply a matter of paying deep, uninterrupted attention?
Wow, that is a brilliant question to leave on. It turns out you don't always need to be in the wrecking ball to build something that feels completely revolutionary. Sometimes the strongest foundation you can possibly have is just the capacity to listen and remember. Definitely something for you to chew on the next time you're tempted to burn everything to the ground and start from scratch.